You are listening to Radio Albion.
This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are listening to the Orthodox Nationalists. Today's date being May 17th, 2026, almost 3 in the morning. Many years ago, it was 2004, I published a book called The Ancient Orthodox Tradition in Russian Literature. And I dealt with two Solzhenitsyn's books, both from the 1960s, The First Circle and The Cancer Ward. They also just so happened to be my favorite works by Solzhenitsyn, as far as fiction is concerned. And what I'm going to do today is I've completely rewritten and revised what I have in that book. That was a long time ago. And I've learned so much from them, and it's my listeners that have kept me independent so I can learn so much since then. And I've gone way beyond that. And it's a wonderful thing. I'm not looking to discover any new skills, but the skills I do have, I'm going to deepen and get better and better at as time goes on. 1960s was a very interesting time for Solzhenitsyn. He was still in the USSR. He was still someone who was looked at as a tremendous danger. But in the 60s, the Stalin era had come to a close. These books were published after 1964, so even Khrushchev was gone by this point. But still, you could never go back. Solzhenitsyn's novels, or these two in particular, the 1960s, the main thing that they get at is freedom, that is to say, autonomy, in relationship to our conscience. But it doesn't end there, because they relate to the state, the nature of both ideological and party rule, meaning Communist Party rule. All of these ideas, it doesn't really, the skeletal parts of the novel. It doesn't matter, because these are all intertwined and brought together to create a more or less coherent theory of moral psychology. And it has been fully understood because they're aimed at those who already accept the Enlightenment assumptions and the Soviet view of history, for that matter, at face value. And that's the big problem. Now, The First Circle, many of you probably already realize, it actually was written between 1958 and 1968. It was only allowed to be published in the Soviet Union in truncated form, in censored form. Of course, derives from Dante. It is essentially limbo. It's limbo, the Latin meaning, the classical Latin meaning, on the edge of, or the edge of. It's where the souls of the pre-Christian philosophers are present. It's not a bad place. It's okay. But he picks it on purpose because this is where this book treats this area of the Gulag system. It's set in Moscow over a three-day period in December of 1949. The First Circle, or in the First Circle, depending on who you look at, comes down to the story of the prisoner Gleb Nurzhinin, a mathematician. He has been at the front. He's been at labor camps. He's been in Russian prisons, because everyone coming back from the front, especially if they've been captured, goes immediately to the camps. There really isn't any specific reason he's sent to the camps, that's just all part of the issue. This is a limbo that was both extremely alienating and a blessing, especially relative to the alternative. These were secret research and development laboratories, operating roughly from the 1920s to 1980s, within the Gulag labor camp system. There were many others. This is called Mavrino. They're not, you know, it's prison. You can't leave there. But the Soviets weren't stupid, like the Americans are. They have brilliant people. They're not just going to put them in a room and say, you can't go anywhere. No, you couldn't put them to work. But they weren't going off to a mining camp in Siberia. Now, the word Sadaska comes up over and over again as a way that this place, the Institute, was... how it was referred to. And initially that word had the meaning of something unreliable. It's an unreliable, untrustworthy place or even group of people, enterprise, organization, whatever it is. Saran, the root of it, means the scum of the earth, riffraff or crook. Saraskina Kantora means an institution organized of crooks, deceit, like a mafia. Or sometimes even a suspicious place or a group of people. But to the party, these were special design bureaus. And it was given the name Saraska because it was extremely deceptive. We'll get into that here right now. Now, the cancer ward does not take place in a camp, although for years I thought it did. A lot of people think it did. And there's good reasons for that, but it doesn't. This is a very different kind of a camp in this book. It also follows a man named Lev Rubin, who I assume is Jewish, a man who was selected as part of an elite group to help spy for the Stalin regime, identifying traitors. He's assigned, prior to his being convicted, of course, he's listening to thousands of phone conversations to try to identify who was speaking and whether the conversation is in any way encoded or something like that. He does the same thing when he's sent to the camp. But this is a relative comfort. They're housed adequately. They're given sufficient food. But again, they can't leave. This is still a prison. It's a nice prison, but it's still a prison. The Soviets manage things. The spies are not aware that they're spies. They don't know that Stalin's attempting a mass cover-up. But at some point, Rubin realizes that he's aiding Soviet evil. And he comes to that because he realizes he's just one cog, very, very, very replaceable in this engine of deception. But he continues working because what's the alternative? He gets sent to the mines of Siberia or something like that. December 24th, 1949, a young Soviet diplomat named Innokenty Volodin calls a friend from a public payphone to warn him against revealing a medical innovation known only to him and his French allies. He's warning about the visit of a specific doctor, Dobrumov in particular, who's presenting research on atomic energy in Paris, and a trap is being laid for him, and he's calling to say, please don't come. The call is traced. By warning the French government, he's alerting them to the sting operation being hatched by foreign NKVD agents. The phone call and the apparatus of the NKVD that it provokes, that's far more important than any story within. It's not really, the story doesn't matter. Of course, I approach this as a historian, as a political ideologist. I'm not a literary critic, though I can be. So, of course, I'm going to say the plot's not that big of a deal. But this call was made from what we would call a payphone. But still, the entire apparatus of the NKVD is alerted. And it's described as a spider web of cause and effect with Stalin at the center. All voices are being recorded. And at the time, the highest tech materials, the Soviet system, are simultaneously activated for all of these phone calls. It's a Gnostic imitation of nature, the interpenetration of each element of the system to create an inorganic whole. Now, Zenin was born in 1918, which means he had to fight in World War II. He knew the Soviet state. He was sent to the Institute, or the Gulag, or prison, or the First Circle, and worked with Lev Rubin. Zenin has knowledge of the client who will benefit from his developing a more efficient voice monitoring system. He's unhappy, because he knows that he's supporting the regime doing this. There's no happy endings here, by the way. Especially as Stalin gets more and more paranoid. And those at the Institute get more and more paranoid. But, you know, a paranoia, it's not really paranoia because it's grounded in reality. Paranoia isn't paranoia, it was real. Everyone from the head of the secret police, the security forces, and the research institute, all the way on down, they all operate under the constant expectation that their time of comparative freedom could be withdrawn and their privileged life eliminated, which in and of itself is a powerful method of control. It's the arbitrariness of it that keeps people docile. So Rubin eventually identifies five suspects for the phone conversation. They arrest all five and they convict one, and that's Innocentiy Volodin. In fact, and at the time, just before that, he alerted the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, but, you know, nothing came of that. But even that call, of course, was recorded. Volodin became popular there. He was an excellent speaker, and he spoke quite a bit on moral imperatives and Immanuel Kant and all the rest. But rebelling exists in theory, but very difficult in practice. Stalin, as this is going on, he's becoming increasingly malicious. There's whole chapters dedicated to this. It's hard to tell in this book where actual history begins and fiction ends. Sometimes you have to remember this is a work of fiction, but of course based very closely on real events. But the Stalin regime becomes increasingly malicious over time, even after the war has placed them very firmly in power. In the book, Stalin believes that there is a growing conspiracy among his own men to eliminate him, and so he has many officers eliminated out of sheer paranoia. Still, given the relative comfort of the Institute, Volodin and his two best friends there at the Institute, Sologdin and Nirzinin, want to revolt by the only weapon they have, refusing to use their minds and skills to further the state's interests. Sologdin, as they find out, had been developing an advanced cryptography machine meant for communication with governments allied with the U.S. So the Soviets gave him a choice. Either we send you to the mines in, where you'll absolutely die, and die a miserable death in Siberia, or you build that same machine for us. Anybody rebelling, Volodin being one, they're removed and they're sent to the worst gulags in the far north and the far east. Again, no happy endings here. It just illuminates how the Stalinist state made it virtually impossible for its prisoners to organize or act morally by stripping them of their basic dignities. Now, this is nothing about the Stalinist state. This was the same as Lenin and Brezhnev. It didn't make any difference. Remember, too, that we're coming to the end of Stalin's life here as well, 49. So in addition to what I said before, we're talking about prison, technology, and its relation to the human conscience. Freedom, of course, is defined in relation to the conscience, the central core of Solzhenitsyn's early work and certainly his work in the 1960s. Now, I know these novels, both of them, are very long. They're, what, 1,200 pages put together? But really, the core of it all is not the phone call, not even the people. It's the voice recognition software that's being developed. The Mervino Institute. Doesn't that sound nice? Doesn't sound like a prison to anybody. Well, the Mervino Institute, you know, that must be working on something very scientific, when in fact, of course, it's a prison. The nature of the phone call, this is Solzhenitsyn's first systematic attempt to create an anti-Soviet or anti-Enlightenment metaphysics. Voice is captured by Soviet recorders and voice recognition technology, which they did, were the first to create. It's broken down into its component parts and recreated so as to isolate its more characteristic features so you could tell which belongs to which. Which comes straight down to classic Enlightenment ideology. Karl Marx believed himself to be the very end and purpose of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment ended with him. It doesn't have to go any farther than that. That's what separated him from the anarchists or the utopian socialists. The anarchists often were the negation of the Enlightenment, where Marx was its fulfillment. Now, there is legitimate philosophical anarchism. I'm not talking about the stupid kids in the street. Often that's the opposite of Enlightenment mechanization. The Soviet ruling class believed that it was the last incarnation of Prometheus and sought as its goal the complete manipulation, domination, and control over nature. Nature was to become, quite literally, human. The function at the command of man, or rather the party. That's not mere theory. There was, in reality, something called the Great Plan for the Transformation of Nature, sometimes called the Stalin's Plan for the Transformation of Nature, second half of the 1940s, so clearly that's what this is all about. For land development, allegedly, water, agriculture, etc., to improve crop yields. I don't think that was the real purpose of it. That was a propaganda phrase, the Great Transformation of Nature. Nature brought under the party's domination. Now, that was a response to the drought in 1946. That drought, you know, it was just Soviet mismanagement that led to 500,000 deaths at least. But regardless, the transformation of nature plan reached none of its goals. Even more, it shows a double talk of the Promethean ideology, talking about the liberatory nature of technology, the control over nature, while deceitfully ignoring or misdirecting from, tensed away from the idea that man's a part of nature. Nature was defined by Trotsky as the peasantry, the ignorant dark masses in need of liberation, or the goyim, who in this Janus world is regimentation in the factory system. That's liberation. So just as the NKVD voice recognition software creates a catalog of human voices by breaking down their vibrations, Solzhenitsyn is breaking down the Promethean ideology of the Enlightenment, and especially its manifestation in the USSR. He also points out the Enlightenment idea of man as merely a series of atoms. I want to note here that Karl Marx's doctoral dissertation at Jena, University of Vienna, was on atomism. It was called The Difference Between the Democritean and Epicurean Philosophy of Nature. They were both atomists. He was a materialist even back then. Man is nothing more than a series of atoms that create, somehow, the personality. By treating the human voice as distinct from personality or anything else, it's just a series of vibrations rather than embedded into a moral conscience. Technology has already stripped any liberatory properties and first rendered as a servant of the state. I mean, the USSR wasn't alone in this regard. But the first circle is really about the institute that developed this software in the 40s. It's a scientific research facility of the first order, as well as a prison. They certainly fooled the West. Fooled them because they wanted to be fooled. The fact that they could be combined together, that's typical Soviet thinking. All of its inmates are well-educated in the sciences and other things. They're not sent to a prison camp. They're put to work. Still, even though they have been convicted of crimes against the Soviet state, they're now a part, an integral part, of the Soviet machine. There seems to be two types of prisoners here. The misunderstood party hack, Rubin is one. And then the idealistic dissident, represented by Nerzhinin. Remember, Rubin is a scientist ordered by Stalin personally to analyze the tape recorded by the spy apparat that was getting ends up getting Volodin arrested. He'd been an NKVD spy during the war, and typical for the era, he was promised good treatment in exchange for loyalty while at Mravino. He was in prison after the war, partially because he'd refused to put into practice Stalin's orders to kill all German POWs. That earned him a ticket to the camps. But again, they didn't want to waste a man with that kind of skill. Volodin, he knew, he liked him very much. But Rubin is your typical Solzhenitsyn character. His conscience is externalized. It's projected. It's projected onto science, the party. Because the party, that's the final word of science. As Marx himself viewed his approach to liberation. He was the final telos, the final goal of science. The externalization of conscience is the core of the anti-Soviet ethic and will recur over and over throughout Solzhenitsyn's career. It's essentially projection. It's the removal of moral judgment from the individual to some externalized entity, either projection or displacement. For Rubin, it is the party that's the embodiment of science, his final expression. So he follows orders without question because the party is greater than he and better than he. It represents Marx's understanding to be the last step of scientific thought. Because everything's material in Rubin's world, there's no conscience outside of science. Science whose final word is being pronounced by the party. It's like the exoskeleton that holds the chaos of atoms together. Within the brain, within the body, within society. It's the skeleton of the new Soviet man. Nerzhinin upbraids Rubin by pointing out the strange inconsistency in Rubin's thinking. Again, something that also Solzhenitsyn will carry throughout his career. Why is the state exempt from the moral laws that are regularly imposed on individuals? Now, there's a lot of political ramifications that come from that. That the state is as much subject to morality as the person, and thus might be judged by the same criterion. Now, in discussing things with Rubin, Nerzhinin represents, argues the idea that there's a part of man that is not reducible to atoms, or their vibrations like the voice, and that's called the conscience. But if this is true, freedom is hence possible outside of physical surroundings. Which, you know, something, common idea to somebody who's been imprisoned. Conscience cannot be externalized. Anyone who tries to is doing out of bad faith. Nerzhinin is the most poorly treated person in the prison, but he remains the happiest. Because he relies on that one non-physical aspect. The soul, the conscience, that of course the Soviet state does not recognize. Modern science doesn't recognize it either. It's a Stoic idea that happiness doesn't depend on physical surroundings. It depends on the guarding of the soul. This freedom that exists solely because the soul is immaterial and thus can't be manipulated by the state, at least not without the will. The idea that freedom is happiness. Happiness can only exist when the soul remains itself, that is, not distorted by external elements. It remains autonomous in conscience. Now, Nerzhinin is offered his freedom, and he refuses it. He says he'd rather be sent to Siberia, where he can be free. the fact that Marino is a creation of the state, the materialist enlightenment anti-culture, treatment there could never be equated with happiness, but only of comfort. Now, I don't know if that's going to work in minus 40 degree weather. And when you're starving and in the mines, a lot worse than minus 40. I don't think you're going to give a damn about metaphysics at that point. He could say it because he's never, he's been to the front, but he's never been to the real bad gulag. Nevertheless, that doesn't alter it doesn't mean his point is false. He's a slave regardless of his treatment, because he remains a cog. He's offered his freedom to become a full-time cryptographer in the pay of Stalin. But what does that mean? It means he has to take orders from the party, so he says go to hell. Only suffering in Siberia can he be free. He says the harshest prisons alone are conducive to freedom and happiness, since it's there and there alone where one can actually live as a full human being. Of course, there's many monastics who have taken that same point of view, that your typical monastic regimen is not sufficient. They could only work out their sins in the most severe cases. You have, Vigla in Mount Athos. The so-called non-possessors built their monasteries, the great St. Nilsorsky in the swamps near Novgorod. I mean, this is not, surrounded by mosquitoes 24 hours a day. But of course, they're also the bearers of civilization. But regardless of that, the starvation rations, the beatings, the cold, the constant reminders that only there can the soul be left alone, subject only to itself, the demands of conscience. Well, no, you're going to be ordered around everywhere you go. I do have a problem with this. He's in prison because he rejected the idea that the party or the enlightenment is his conscience. I don't think as he's starving and hallucinating, after he's lost 80 pounds, is he going to be, theorizing about the Stoics and the saints of Vigla in Mount Athos? I doubt that. But it doesn't mean that his point isn't real. So let me summarize. I'm trying to do, it's hard to summarize a 900-page book. But let me do it here. And I think I have 8 elements that do it in the first circle. And this is, number one, happiness but not comfort can be found anywhere. It's a state of mind. In fact, external factors are the sole barrier against happiness that turns the Western utilitarian myth on its head. Number two, there's an immediate connection between the state and the Enlightenment, of course. The Enlightenment created the modern state. It constructed a world built on material objects. This is the scientific world of the Enlightenment. The control over the unexplained motion of such objects is a job of science. They analyze their motions and, as a result, predict their course. Once that's done, you build a set of institutions that promotes what they consider happiness for the greatest number, which really is the application of stimuli such that the motions of nature are conducive to good feelings, strictly speaking. This is a basic Victorian morality based on utility. Number three, the Enlightenment is based on the interconnection of all external stimuli, since they're all reducible to atoms, ultimately, and their vibration. I don't know how you avoid totalitarianism in this case. If force is applied in one direction, it will eventually affect everything. Everything is connected. It's graphically shown in this novel, in the beginning, where the vibrations of Volodin's voice create a chain reaction of activation of the NKVD's entire apparatus, this inorganic dystopian anti-nature. It's all cause and effect. And of course, there's no freedom. Nijinin, 4, is a humanist, in the best sense of the word. I hate that word. I shouldn't be using it. But let's put it this way. He's not motivated by ideology. He doesn't externalize anything. If Rubin is Huxley, then Nijinin is Tolstoy. searching but always cheerful, the proper state of man to understand the world around him. That impulse is snuffed out by ideology, or the full identification of society and the self with the historical idea, because all ideologies really claim to be the end of history, including the one we live in. Number 5 is about the janitor, who I haven't mentioned yet, Spiridon Yegorov. It's funny, he fought both for the Reds and the Whites in the Civil War, whoever paid him the most. At one point, he lived in a high society life. He wasn't fully literate, though, but he was always very happy. He turns out to be the wisest of all, because his fortunes go up and down. You can't base happiness on it. He's experienced everything and has come to the conclusion that happiness is possible in the highest, most exalted positions, especially in those positions. Material progress is not related to happiness or satisfaction. Now, if we were to adopt that conception, that would cause a questioning of all modern institutions and social theories. If happiness is the satisfaction, a certain peace of the soul, a soul that has freed itself from, as Solzhenitsyn says, the spinning atoms of the external world, material progress is not just unrelated to happiness, it becomes a barrier to it. 6, Siberia is a symbol of freedom, in more ways than one. That's not new in Russian literature, of course. It's a symbol of freedom because prison is the only place in the Soviet Union where one is freed from all of these attachments. Yeah, you'll be freed from your attachments, all right, like your limbs. If atoms are directionless of themselves, you know, in a vacuum, then science is given the role of providing order with the goal of maximum pleasure. That's the other face of Janus, the face that said if all is material, then science is totalitarian. Hence, by its own definition, it's in charge of placing order on the chaos of material, which ipso facto is everything, including you, including your brain. Utilitarianism is totalitarianism. 7, the incomprehension of the Janus-like nature of modernity. This is illustrated all over the place. Now, I know I've mentioned this before, but this is the first place where it was ever brought up. Nerzhinin is being taken to Siberia to the mines in a truck. The truck is disguised as a meat delivery service, delivering meat to local groceries. So a French journalist supposed to be writing on the USSR dispatches a story home, rhapsodizing about the plenty to be found in the Soviet Union. It is the wave of the future. How many meat trucks has he seen since he's been in the USSR? That's the first time. I know I've mentioned that. That's the first time this has ever been uttered or written is in this story. And that's one of the most, and it actually, you know, variations of that actually did occur. The Western press wanted to believe that the Soviet Union was this wonderful place. 8, finally, if the pure soul is at the basis of happiness, part of this purity is the untrammeled ability to make moral decisions. We're talking about Kant's conception of autonomy, which is really part of the patristic idea, because material distortions, inner or outer, vitiate the nature of moral choice. If the soul is being influenced by passions, by material things, external forces, internal forces, then whatever choice you make is going to be distorted. Moral law exists precisely in that it is not dependent on external forces. It exists in itself, self-defined as an integral part of the personality. Despite Kant, moral idealism is radically incompatible with the Enlightenment ideology. It bases its own ideology, especially in Marxism, on the progressive nature of things like production. The free persona is the pure soul. But you know what? Even if some of this is true, then happiness is to be found through suffering. And you don't have a choice in the matter. Most of us don't have a choice in the matter. Only through suffering, the usual props and buttresses of external comforts, not a part of the moral imagination, are removed. Autonomy ultimately comes through suffering. Solzhenitsyn has now built the structure of a moral idea by equating freedom with suffering, and this freedom hence with happiness. Of course, Solzhenitsyn's talking about the Soviet Union as a giant prison. But there's islands of happiness in it, like this research institute. Now, most of the protagonists here have lost their wives, their homes, their influence, their power and money, and everything else. The Institute offered them a little bit of dignity and basic humanity. Many of them end up being sent to the worst. I think the worst was Vorkuta. This is above the Arctic Circle, a huge network of coal mines, slave labor, temperatures going to negative 75 degrees Fahrenheit. A million people died there from 1932 to 1962. The official number is 200,000. I don't believe it. That's where some of these guys were sent. As they were dying in the coal mines, something tells me that they weren't thinking about the Stoics. So there is a part of me that rebels against this mentality, even though that does not vitiate the fact that it's true. Now, most of these guys are political prisoners, but they're asked to help their government once again in order to benefit themselves. It's a tricky test. Volodin almost creates a rebellion here. Many of the prisoners stop helping the state. They stop doing what they're supposed to be doing. They prefer less comfortable prisons than to serve the corruption of the state. I have the feeling they've never been there. I mean, the real bad ones, the Vorkutas of the world. In truth, and finally, freedom is found nowhere, since in the worst camps, theory is the last thing on man's mind. Now let's go to the cancer ward. For whatever reason, I love stories and TV shows and movies about institutions. Hospitals, prisons. Prisons is a big one. I subscribe to all those guys on YouTube. My favorite work from Chekhov is Ward Number 6. The cancer ward, I have to understand, I for years I thought it was like where Johnny Sack died in The Sopranos. Like it was the medical ward of a prison. You're not just in the gulag, but you're also dying of cancer. It is not. I just kind of think that it's Solzhenitsyn's fiction, therefore it must have something to do with the gulag. But in this case, it doesn't. The cancer ward is actually a regular cancer institute, a terrible one, a really bad one. It was finally published in 1968. It takes place in the mid-50s. This is a filthy, overcrowded hospital in Kazakhstan, the Tashkent Medical Institute. Staffed entirely by women. Sometimes badly staffed by women. Now, why is that? It's the case because so few men were left in the USSR in 1955. It's that simple. Not to mention the fact that a real MD was not considered a very high-level job at the time. It's simply... It's nowhere near the way that most people consider an MD today. The main protagonist is Oleg Kostuglotov. It's an interesting last name. The name means bone or very rarely a structure, kost, or either swallow or absorb, glotat. So the swallow of a bone. Anyway, he is a worker. He's a war veteran. In permanent exile from Ust-Terek in Kyrgyzstan. He might be cured, unlike his fellow patients. He's very sexually active, even while he's on the ward. Because apparently some of these doctors are very attractive. That's all they really have going for them. The treatment is very poor. I mean, there are some women who care and are vaguely competent. But Soviet Kazakhstan was not known for oncology. But it was known for cancer. We'll explain that in a little bit. The first part of the novel, and I had to read, I did reread both of these. a lot of secondary sources. There's a huge amount of work goes into these lectures. A huge amount of work. But the first part of the novel, you see the patients as utterly helpless. Their tumors continue to grow, and you could see them. Even ordinary actions are difficult. Their mobility is restricted. It's weird that there are so many cancer patients in Kazakhstan. But Kostoglotov occasionally is able to take walks. Now, as the patients get more and more desperate, they start looking around for cures that we find on the web once in a while. At one point, they think that radioactive gold would cure them. No one can get any. They believe that tea from a tree fungus can be a cure, maybe. And Kostoglotov is curious. He studies the treatment of cancer. He understands what's going on around him. And he also knows that most of the patients will die around him. The hospital releases terminal cases in the final stages, not so much to hospice, but simply lets them go home. Now, the story, among other things, explores the moral responsibility of those implicated in Stalin's crimes. One patient worries that a man he condemned and sent to prison will seek revenge now that he's out in the post-Stalin world. So many people, these mid-level bureaucrats sent so many people to prison or killed people, and their families are after them. Now they've been all rehabilitated. One patient, this is a very famous line. One patient says to him, and this is a weird thing. He's looking for sympathy. He says, "You haven't had to do much lying, huh? Yeah, you were arrested, but we were herded into meetings to expose you. They executed people like you, but they made us stand up and applaud the verdicts. And not just applaud, they made us demand the firing squad. Demand it." Poor thing. Well, the version of Rubin here is a man named Pavel Rusanov. Actually, he's much worse than Rubin, but a similar character. He's a bully. He's an extreme form of a bully. He has high status in the party, but he is a very sick man. How did he get his office? How did he get his status in the party? He would denounce those whose jobs he wanted. Very simple. However, Stalin's gone. That system, I mean, of course, that system's always going to exist. But the Khrushchev de-Stalinization means that some of these guys that now that he's denounced are now rehabilitated, and they want revenge. He's terrified that Stalinist loyalists like him have gone out of power forever. I feel terrible for him. The other patients mock him all the time. In fact, it was his daughter that brings him the news that retaliation has begun against those who delivered false evidence against the victims of, against these people that they put away. That's something that Rusanov has done constantly in his career. The Soviet state privilege, it doesn't matter whether Stalin or otherwise. Stalin was not special in that regard. The camps didn't stop after Stalin, and they were created before Stalin. Stalin just created a much larger bureaucracy because he could. Stalin simply wasn't able to do that. But under Stalin or Brezhnev, that system privileged those like Rusanov. Like Rusanov's son, he becomes a low-level judge. And his father hates him because he's very lenient. He doesn't want to shoot the guy ahead of him so he can go and get his job. He doesn't understand that. But he has cancer now. Still, it's really hard to change his whole personality. Many of them have to realize that their lives are over. Rusanov only really cares about signs of reform around him. He fears specifically a rehabilitated man he denounced 20 years ago to obtain the whole apartment that they shared. He's going to be coming for him. So even if he's cured, but he doesn't want to go back to where he's from. Even if he's cured, there's nothing left for him to go back to. Once he's discharged, he is discharged. He believes he's cured, but the women doctors privately give him less than a year to live. At the end, Luciano's wife drops garbage from her car window, which is what they used to do. Party members used to do that back then. It's true, the clinic staff always misled the patients about the severity of their diseases and discharged patients that they couldn't help. So the number of patients dying there was kept at a minimum. So they were, you know, they were a great hospital. Now, Kostoglotov likes women, as all normal men do. Women in this Kazakh play, they're all Russian women. But he has a problem. His virility is at stake. I mean, he served as a soldier in the war. He was an exile to Central Asia. There's a brief improvement in his condition, so he's able to go for walks, as I said before. Other patients are dying. He can go where he wants to. And this should have hit, you know, give me a hint. This isn't a prison. The world's beauty, especially women, continue to invigorate him. He'd been deprived of it for a very long time. He has two romances while he's in the ward. Two doctors, doctors in quotes, who are treating him. Vera Gangart, who was pretty much his age, and the younger doctor, Ludmila Donstova, for her physical attractiveness. Now, he's been taking hormones. These hormones there will leave him impotent, or possibly will leave him impotent. He avoids treatment, which is a problem. Donstova likes this idea. We don't know what the side effect obviously was. But both women eventually come to know each other and that he's betrayed them. Among other reasons, for not submitting to the recommended treatment properly and pursuing the other woman. Still, typical alpha, he gains a measure of forgiveness from them. Relationships are never the same, but he still has severe choices to make. There's another one, Diomka, a young trade school student, and his girlfriend Aisha. They want to amputate Diomka's leg. But his girlfriend just simply says no. It would rob him of his prowess, of his masculinity. However, Aisha comes in a little while later because she has breast cancer. She has to have the afflicted breast removed. Now, why the hell do so many people have cancer here? There's very good reason for it. Something called the Semipalatinsk test site, the polygon, sometimes called SEMA-21 in Kazakhstan. Between 1949 and 1989, the Soviets conducted nearly 500 nuclear tests there without even telling the local population downwind. In fact, that was part of the purpose. Around 2 million people were exposed to high levels of radioactive fallout, severe fallout. The cancer rates were 30% higher than the national average. And you had extreme spikes in infant mortality and all kinds of complications. So all the one person after another, every character has cancer, including some of the doctors. All of a sudden, this is why. This is artificially created. Lots of people in this part of Kazakhstan have cancer. Maybe even most of them. That's why. This is why it was very difficult to publish this book in the USSR. Anyway, Kostoglotov reads Tolstoy, which is sometimes a good idea, sometimes isn't. He reads What Do Men Live By, 1881. It's a story about an angel who comes back to Earth. Given a mission, he has to discover several things. What men live by, what they don't live by, what they don't know, what they should know. Actually, three things. And talking about salvation at any price, he believes some sacrifices ought not to be made, even to protect one's life. He's very influenced by Tolstoy. He starts talking about love in the abstract sense that Tolstoy does. But none of the patients are prepared to accept anything like this. They're all typical Soviet types. Mechanistic, materialist. That's their idea. Of course, the hospital is a metaphor for the empire. And it matters, too, that the doctors are always lost. Either they're incompetent or they simply can't handle the sheer number of cancer that this thing has caused. Vera, one of the doctors, also has cancer. She goes home to see an old general practitioner, which is probably better than being in the cancer ward. An inept doctor at the ward, a party stooge, creates a show trial for a decent medical staffer. And Vera and Lev Leonidovich go to derail what they deem an obscene proceeding. It doesn't really matter, but it just shows you that these people are so set in their ways. If something goes wrong, someone dies, one of the patients wants a show trial. The little people, the people who, even you know, sometimes major party people, especially once they have cancer, have no power anymore. Compared to the first circle, there's a company. You know, it's very easy to compare Rubin and Rusanov. They're very similar characters. They both place their trust in external things: ideology, theory, the party, the state. Rusanov is a servile informer. He expresses everything evil, not merely in respect to the USSR. That's obvious enough. But the far more abstract notion of the externalized conscience. Now, this book was banned by the party for a while. Not forever, but for a while. Solzhenitsyn's writings weren't merely attacks on the USSR. I mean, obviously they were. But the absurdity of the Soviet system was just an excuse to attack the Enlightenment more broadly. Especially Prometheus, the Lightbearer, who was not mentioned, but of course that's the main Enlightenment figure. This will permit the domination of nature in exchange for sacrifice, that is, the slavery and enslavement of labor, those a huge power grid, a huge regulatory state, foreign wars, colonies, maintenance of cheap fuel sources, continuing battle between state complex and labor, and the continual squeezing of workers for increased profit and market share. And both systems, capitalists and communists, had to do it. That's the price for progress. That's the price for everything that we buy in the store. Walmart could offer low prices because they're squeezing somebody. A regime, in the true sense, a system is formed. Or private kind of state and semi-private capital all create an authoritarian grid of thought and action that's put in the service of power. It's an oligarchy, and therefore, it's secretive and conspiratorial. The Soviets placed themselves as the venerators of progress. Darwin was absolutely essential, as Marx said. Progress again, the creation of an entire complex, human sacrifice. This is what human sacrifice is. The fact that it's institutionalized doesn't mean it's any less a human sacrifice. The maze of foreign and internal entanglements that permit a complete regimentation of all levels. Technology must be served by an entire web of forces that keep the system going. That's the reality that Rusanov manifests. The Enlightenment, of course, is found at its highest levels, according to Marx and Lenin, in the USSR. But to function in it, it requires servility, the bureaucratic mentality, and can't deal with criticism very well. I mean, 100 years ago, a family could go off-grid, since there was no grid to begin with. We weren't hooked up to a web of utilities all the time. Today, maybe only those raised in rural poverty could possibly pull it off. I'm criticized once in a while for anti-modernist stuff, agrarian stuff, you know. And my response is usually, well, I can't help the year I was born. It's not my fault I was born in 1971, and I was raised long before I knew any of this stuff. with these expectations that technology has provided me. I couldn't do any of this without the web. Again, that has no bearing on whether or not the criticism is true or not. Everything I've said above is true, despite the year of my birth. I can't help it that I was born into a system that fed me these expectations from a very early age. I don't know of any other life. Part of my life is to show that they lived better in the Middle Ages and in other places because I can't place myself there. I wouldn't know what to do there. That's not my fault. One has nothing to do with the other. Now, Rusanov has a nightmare. He's crawling through a pipe of some kind. He sees a little girl at the end, the daughter of a man Rusanov had put in prison. The same guy that he concocted crimes so he can get a better apartment. In fact, Rusanov had become famous for creating crimes and blaming them on people whose living space, a car, any other external thing that he coveted he can get. Regardless of the long-time materialization of the personality conscience, a spark of conscience still exists, and this dream proves it. It only manifests itself during dreams. A world where the will does not function. His conscience is pricked by this little girl, who of course was affected by this. We didn't have a father because of this. That's all it is. It's a little girl at the end of a pipe of some sort. But this is a cancer ward. It's a hospital environment, no different than a prison in the earlier novel. The main characters all have it, excepting most of the doctors. On Chekhov's in Ward Number 6, the hospital is a metaphor for social life, the state and the system that encapsulates both. It's a lot of desperation among the patients with these huge tumors that no one can control. Rusanov and Podyuev, who's another inmate of the ward, suddenly they get interested in spontaneous healing, more accurately, a direct action of God upon the human body. Podyuev is, in good old believer fashion, saying that a pure soul is capable of self-healing, and asceticism is a key to that. Now, we all know a few things. A strict regimen of fasting can cure or prevent some diseases that the body will begin consuming diseased cells and tissues. There might be a solid secular and legitimately scientific understanding of fasting, but the more spiritual understanding of fasting is that it brings people beyond the present, beyond the vulgar world of cause and effect, the lowest elements of creation. Fasting over time opens the senses, permits greater insights and deeper concentration. Of course, the Enlightenment had rejected all of this. Immediate pleasure through technology was the goal. And that became the very exoteric nature of progress. Fasting and things like that was just folk medicine. You don't work with nature to get what you want. Medicine is now replacing nature. The medieval and classical view was to use it. Now, purity of life and conduct do have a healing quality. It's a secular reason why all traditional religions, in Orthodoxy, Islam, practice fasting. It's a departure from the cause and effect world of fallen objects. And over time, the core of the world, the ultimate religious core of the world, can be found. Over a long time, these things can be experienced. Church fathers always said some variation of the phrase, the Holy Spirit cannot be perceived on a full stomach. That might be somewhat of an exaggeration, but you get the drift. The mind's eye has to be heightened. The energy and the oxygen used for digestion has to then be rerouted to the mind. Ritual, fasting, manual labor, as well as a regimen of intellectual labor, leads to a completely new relationship to created objects. Now you note, I just laid out the monastic life. On Mount Athos, the average lifespan is just under 100. Partially because there's no women there, no doubt. and none of them have to drive. That's probably a big part of it. They have a hospital there, or a clinic there, staffed by a guy from the Aristotle University of Athens. But he doesn't have much to do. It's because the physical labor, the intellectual labor, as well as ritual and fasting, not to mention a strong sense of brotherhood and purpose and belief. You never stop exercising in Athens. There's no way to. On the other hand, Rubin, Rusanov, they believe in dogma in the very worst sense, that reality can be expressed through written manifestos and pamphlets. This is the evil of ideology and modernism. That's why Kostoglotov is a hero here. Not quite like Nerzhinin, but there are parallels. Again, I don't think plots are all that big of a deal. Plots are excuses to deal with the very serious philosophical problems brought up by the evils of the Soviet Union. The evils of the Enlightenment manifest in the Soviet Union, the state and the industrial economy. The USSR is a little different because Stalin demanded that the USSR overtake the West in industrial production only in a few years. From a purely economic point of view, this was part of the reason the camps had to be expanded. The camps, at any given time, this is after Stalin as well, made up between 10 and 20% of the Soviet economy. When the normal economy struggled, the slack was taken up by the camp population. It was a prop to the economy. It alone gave the pretense of fulfilling the infamous 5-year plans. The camp populations, dying at an alarming rate, needed to be refurbished by contrived arrests from the outside. These are the people who liberated the camps in German camps in Poland and projected their evils onto these camps. That's the entire thing of Nuremberg, the Nuremberg lie. But the relation between camp life and normal Soviet life is brought up all the time. But in a way that it's applicable everywhere. Anywhere that we live, that elites have chosen the Enlightenment over traditional agriculture and things like home industries. I stand with Iran and this war that the U.S. has already lost because, you know, they are a very scientific society without leaving traditional confines. Iran is a huge economic success story. And had there been no warfare or sanctions or that, it would be an extremely wealthy economy. Why is it that Iran has the lowest suicide rate? Or one of the lowest suicide rates on the planet? But the industrial life requires all-out social regimentation and centralization. The parallels between prison and work life become way too serious for comfort. We know that at their ideological roots, postmodern capitalism and Marxism are similar, if not identical. And you see it in both novels. Both these novels are focused on the nature of freedom and the advanced enlightenment. Both the U.S. and its allies, as well as the USSR, claim to be the final word of the end of history. And both believe themselves to be dedicated to science and scientific rationality, that production is the greatest calling of man. Both systems believed that they were in the process of solving all social and medical problems through progress and industrialization. See, Rusanov hasn't just externalized his conscience, but like all rationalists, he's externalized his reason. The main point of both these novels is that rationalism has become an idol. It creates institutions and movements that claim to be in the position of interpreting nature and history, providing it with a goal and force a society to be oriented towards it. For Solzhenitsyn, the characters of Rubin and Rusanov are used to express the final guttering out of rationalism and so-called progress and Darwinism. Darwinism is essential to both capitalism and Marxism. These men, these characters speak in cliches and slogans, all out of the party handbook, This isn't knowledge. But this mentality, you find it in the post-Enlightenment age, in the post-modern age, where everything from evolutionism to feminism is treated as coming from a canon, a catechism. And if you do that, you can become a part of the system. And you receive mainstream approbation as a result. You then become a reasonable person. We can trust you now. Before they coined the phrase virtue signal, I coined the phrase membership card slogans. Those who refuse do podcasts on the internet or go to prison. Kostoglotov comes to realize that people who definitely know better, you know, bureaucrats, philosophers, scientists, clergy, it's not a matter of epistemology, but what they do is a matter of survival. You know, how many times have I gone after modern academics? Yeah, there's a certain sour grapes to it, but that's only a small amount of it. I'm very self-aware. But there's, I don't know how I could function there, especially after 2020. A young grad student comes into the academic world. They're called an intellectual. They become a professor. They're given captive audiences. They can lecture. They're treated as part of the modern cognoscenti, a high salary, an office with their name on the door, a little work and a few classes. It's a very comfortable life. But there's a corporate culture, not unlike every other job you could easily get. A way of thinking and acting that's not necessarily laid out dogmatically, but you perceive it everywhere. It's a part of the normal groupthink of the institution upon which he depends, professor depends, or the bureaucrat depends. Certain things are expected of them. Ideological assumptions. There aren't necessarily arguments, but a basic mindset from which all other arguments should derive. I always like to say that many of my white male professors would not be liberals if they were plumbers or electricians. And I think that's true. They made proper adjustments to a corporate culture that's given them a very easy job. It's more obvious in you know, white males than females, but the expectations are the same. The price attached to nonconformity is extremely high. And many young PhDs only know the regime's point of view. They don't even know that people like me exist. It's in their professional interest to not know. And since they're part of a prestigious institution, prestige almost provides them in a circular way legitimacy. That's the psychology of groupthink. It comes with rewards and punishments. What's the ultimate punishment? Rejection of tenure. A professional death sentence. No one but tenured academics in the department are allowed to vote on tenure. Not students, not the alumni, the community, nobody. That's how conformity is enforced by a rigid and highly secretive system. Some of these people in this, within that very system, I mean, most people who are writing on this very system are from that very cognoscenti. They'll read this and they'll think that Solzhenitsyn's talking about someone else. He's not. Nikolai Gogol, the government inspector, says the exact same thing. No. Solzhenitsyn's talking to you. The Middle Ages had a complete lack of bureaucracy for all aspects of life. Even the Byzantine Empire, the Papal Curia, had minimal bureaucracy compared to the modern megastate today. It's the state that created today's economic relationships, which is something that the libertarians never understood. Thus, the state has the power to regulate them. The state consciously destroyed traditional ways of living, the local autonomous farm community to the urban artel, to use a Russian term, so to clear the way for the new rational and efficient economic system benefiting them as capitalism. The Jews were a huge factor here. Liberalism and capitalism, let alone socialism, are the creations of state power in conjunction with local interests, eliminating the natural state of man, that is, small, tightly knit farming communities, based on religion, the extended family. There's also Nietzsche, in both of these novels, the village prose movement might be a part of this too. Progress and technophilia, they're not about making life better. That's never been the case. The Lunar Society of England took into itself hundreds of the highest elites in capitalist society in the 17th, 18th century. It was a secret, quasi-Masonic society. They were dedicated to anything but the improvement of life, but technological innovation to improve their own standing in society. The Royal Society, of course, is better known and more public, much less secretive. The Lunar Society spent millions funding revolutionary groups in France, Central Europe, and Russia. Technology is manifest in the USSR and the USA as an excuse for evil. Anything goes if it's done in the name of progress. Certainly a growing number of formerly ignorant people are getting the dim outline of the price, the sacrifice necessary for progress. Permanent war, permanent empire, permanent bureaucracy, and surveillance. The World Institute for Development Economic Research claims that the world's wealth is concentrated in exactly 2% of the world's people. This interests the remainder because they have been sacrificed on the altar of Prometheus. And for that 2%, most of us are superfluous. Solzhenitsyn asked the common sense question about technology and its proper use. Now, it sounds like the cancer ward could use a little more technology. In the first novel, they could use much less. The Soviets were quite advanced in that regard, but only for the salvation of the state. Those with money, people who already have money, they commission technological innovation according to their wishes. They use it then for their own interests. The scientific establishment can't think objectively. That's their corporate myth, because they require money to function. And money exists solely in the hands of that elite. And it makes no difference if that elite is from the party, a state, a private, whatever. And they have to think the same way, or they don't get money. It doesn't matter whether Bilderberg, the WCC, or the party plenum. It doesn't make any difference. Solzhenitsyn is creating parallels between the state, the Enlightenment, and party thinking, conformism, technology, freedom. Freedom needs to be redefined in Solzhenitsyn's idea. A situation where the omni-state is not going away. In fact, more and more mobilized interest groups are demanding favors from it. Long ago, I made the statement that modern politics is easily reducible to bargaining agreements between the state on the one hand and mobilized groups on the other, feminists, universities, etc. The state provides favors while the group promises loyalty. Near the end of the book, Kosuglotov realizes that the damage done to him and to Russia is probably too great to be repaired. There is no healing now that Stalin is long gone. He's forgotten how to live a normal life. Funny, on the day of his release from the hospital, he went to a zoo. And he sees in these captured animals people he knew. He says this. Well, this is Solzhenitsyn as a narrator. The most confusing thing about the imprisoned animals was that even supposing Oleg took their side and had the power, he would still not want to break into the cages and liberate them. This was because, deprived of their home surroundings, they lost the idea of rational, their own freedom. It would only make things harder for them, suddenly to set them free. That was the odd way Kosuglotov reasoned. His brain was so twisted, he could no longer see things simply and dispassionately. Whatever he experienced from now on, there would always be this shadow, this gray specter, this subterranean rumbling from the past. Well, it wasn't in the past. He was still living in a totalitarian system, just not a Stalinist one. mean, there's no significant element of the population, east or west, that's not either getting something from the state or expecting to get something from the state. Therefore, freedom has to be redefined internally as a rational or radical response to imprisonment. Every act that brings us into contact with the regime forces compromise. Hence, freedom is impossible. In the very early writings of Solzhenitsyn, prison and death are the two elements that manifest freedom. Dostoevsky is actually very, very similar in that respect. Death, literally death, the end of one's earthly life, forces a purely objective portrayal of life, hence the cancer ward, or the concentration camp. The other is the prison, where compromise isn't necessary because the person isn't necessarily working for the regime, isn't directly working for the regime at all. He's its enemy and pronounced its enemy. So at least prison promotes integrity. Zinin wants to be deported to Siberia rather than work as a cryptographer for the NKVD. Great public prestige, high salary, everything else. There are several worlds that Solzhenitsyn builds and creates. Identical in content, but very different in form. Modern society at large, the prison, the hospital, and political leadership. They differ in obvious ways, but not necessarily in content. Like the wide-eyed assistant professor, for example, the more subtle forms of coercion are the most effective. When rewards are great and punishments more so. Freedom of conscience, in the non-cliché way, appropriated in these works, is a very rare gift. The mind seems forcibly canalized, that is to say, forced into it like a canal, given the world where one is forced to conform. Just like muscle memory, you have mental memory. Freedom of conscience necessarily entails punishment and pain. Liberalism demands an amorphous freedom that usually resolves itself into bourgeois greed. Things like, free sex, abortion, usury, easy divorce. None of these are actual manifestations of freedom, but rather slavery to the passions and those who allow those passions to be satiated, at least temporarily. Certain forms of coercion and conformity that go under the cover of freedom, solely for the reason that if the ordinary people in America can pursue their interests, then there is no place to stand when you criticize the elite for pursuing theirs. Thank you, everyone, for listening, as always. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.